Charity, that was such a poetic meditation. There was one line you used, the remains of my days will last longer than my, outlive my remains. Love that. So in your bulletin, there are two readings. I'm going to share the first one to get us started off. The answer is not to turn inward, to retreat into competing factions, distrusting those who don't look like you, or worship the way you do, or don't get their news from the same sources you do. We must end this uncivil war that pits red against blue, rural versus urban, conservative versus liberal. We can do this if we open our souls instead of hardening our hearts, if we show a little tolerance and humility. And that was President Biden at his inaugural address on January 20th, 2021. Over the past few years, I, like maybe many of you, have been confronted with the possibility that I've been wrong. If not with the facts, then how I've chosen to use those facts. And like never before, I've started second-guessing myself, wondering if I'm the one who's wrong, and the people or ideas I think are so incredibly wrong might actually be in the right. And I want to share a quick story about one example that surfaced, and this was from a year and a half ago or so. And I'm guessing the story might be familiar to some of you because you've experienced your own version of it. It's an unusually warm day in March of 2021 in West Michigan, and I am taking Ginger, our senior pup, for a walk at Hackley Park in downtown Muskegon. And I decide it's the perfect time to catch up with a friend. Since the pandemic began more than a year ago, I had fallen out of touch with a lot of people, as many of us had. So we casually chat for a few minutes before our conversation inevitably turns to a heavier topic, the virus, and how we're each coping in the ways it's turned our lives upside down. I know she and I have shared values, but sometimes differ on political beliefs. So there's a slight undercurrent of tension that I feel anyway when I say, I can't wait to get the vaccine. I'm on a few lists and I'm hoping I get called in the next month. She replies, oh, that's good. I'm sure your name will come up soon. When she doesn't offer to share her own views on the subject, I have a choice. I can ignore her. I can just give silence on the matter. It's a personal decision after all. It's none of my business. Or I can ask her about her intentions in the spirit of care and concern. After all, her health and well-being are important to me and to those who love her. I decide to err on the side of concern. Are you planning to get vaccinated? I asked. She replies, well, I've been doing some research. At which point, I feel my breathing go a little shallow and a knot form in my stomach. She goes on to share that she believes that the risks outweigh the benefits. There's so much we still don't know, she says. I listen and I try to keep an open mind while simultaneously thinking, no, that's not an option. We know enough. Again, I have a choice in how I respond. I can let it go, I can push gently, or I can push hard. I want her to see the situation in the same way I do, as an urgent crisis that we have to respond to, and that we have this response in the form of a simple shot in the arm, that we have a moral and societal obligation to do our part to flatten the curve. That's a term I haven't heard in a while, so it's kind of nice to say it and feel like it's in the past. That we need to trust the science, trust the vaccine, and take action to protect ourselves and our families and our neighbors. Can't she see this? Doesn't she know how wrong she is and how right I am? But I know from past conversations that to force my perspective on her would be pointless. I'm torn because if I don't push back, isn't that neglecting a responsibility? Is accepting her reply sending a subtle message that says, fine, do whatever you want. If you suffer, you suffer. I push back a little, telling her that I really wish she would get the vaccine, as I want her to stay safe and healthy. I ask her what research she's found that says it's not safe. She assures me that she's getting information from reliable sources. And yes, she will send me some links. I admit to her that I've not done a lot of research myself, so I might have missed something. Even as I make that admission, I still feel like at the end of the day, I'm right and she's wrong. But I try to leave space for the possibility that I at least don't have all the answers. So when I get home from my walk, I do my due diligence and I try to find the research that she cited. When I don't find much, I focus on sources that bolster my perspective that the vaccine is safe, making sure that they are politically neutral, non-media sites. I email those links to her and request that she share what she has with me. Her response doesn't surprise me. Oddly enough, the videos and posts that she was referring to are gone, since there are people out there who want to silence the truth. She wrote, "People are deemed guilty of not adhering to the service agreement, which is that nothing you can say can go against the approved narrative. There is only now one view that can be voiced." So I'm faced with yet another choice point. Start a debate by offering facts and counter arguments to her statements, pretend she didn't say any of it, or acknowledge without engaging. And I choose a variation of that third option. I focus on her assurances that she's staying safe. I don't acknowledge her words about the media or censorship. I write, "I'm really glad you're being cautious. I saw via a tracker that risk level in your area is very high, so please continue to take good care." And that response effectively ended the conversation, which was fine by me. So what caused me to dial back that strong impulse to tell her that she was all wrong? What shifted as I reflected on how to respond lovingly to someone that I felt was making a bad choice? It was humility. I took a moment to move past the layers of righteousness that I was feeling. I tried, and this is, I think, the most important one that really turned it for me. I tried to recognize that my desire to control her choices were wrong because I thought I knew what was best for her. I did my best to leave space for the prospect that there's truth in what she says, or at least that she makes a point that there's a lot we don't know yet about the vaccines and their efficacy. And remember, I'm talking a year and a half ago. I decided to accept the possibility that I might be wrong about something. And even as I say that, accept the possibility that I might be wrong, I really have to fight the urge to say, "even though I'm not." There are some uncomfortable truths that our egos don't like to hear. We're all gonna die. We're a blip on the radar, a speck in the universe. We ultimately have little control over our lives, and maybe free will, as we've talked about here in the past month, is an illusion. And we might be wrong about something, anything, or everything. We understand death is inevitable, but being wrong isn't. So when we're confronted with that possibility of being wrong, it's natural to resist it. As Richard Rohr says, the human ego prefers anything, just about anything, to falling, changing, or dying, or being wrong. The ego is that part of you that loves the status quo, even when it's not working. It attaches to past and present and fears the future. And here, as you hear those words status quo, you can think of that as our unwavering belief in whatever truth that we hold dear. And that's what makes this a big question in my mind. It's different from, is there a God, or what is truth, or is the universe friendly? Because we can play with those questions as an intellectual exercise. And the answer, if there is one, isn't necessarily a direct challenge to our identity. And when we're asking, you know, what if I'm wrong, that's much more perhaps about whether we're wrong about a core belief. And that makes us one of those big questions that's more difficult to ask because it feels like there's more at stake and that the risks are more significant and more personal. The ego will kick and scream that it's right, that they're wrong, end of story. Ego doesn't want to let humility lead. Its very identity is bound to certain truths and beliefs and perspectives. And if I'm wrong about the one thing I know is true, doesn't that make everything else suspect? What else am I wrong about? What if I'm wrong about everything? Society would be in a really bad place if people didn't accept that sometimes they got it wrong. What have we gotten wrong in the past? The Earth is not flat. The planet Earth is not the center of the universe, nor is the United States. Homosexuality is not a deviant behavior or choice. We're still working on people accepting that truth. No human being should ever be counted as 3/5 of a person for any reason. Climate change is real, another reality that, when denied, has dire consequences. On the lighter side, we've realized it's okay to eat less than an hour before swimming, that going hatless in the winter isn't going to cause you to lose any more heat than not wearing gloves or a scarf, and that we definitely use more than 10% of our brains on a daily basis. It all makes you wonder what people will look back on 25 or 50 or 100 years from now and shake their heads wondering, how could they have gotten it so wrong? And I asked that question during pre-talk, and a number of things came up, and some of them popped into my head and other things that were people shared. Maybe our military spending. We will have gotten that wrong. The death penalty. That any human being should be homeless. That we don't have health care for everyone. That we're not moving fast enough from dependence on fossil fuels. That we're letting our democracy fail. Animal testing. And this is kind of a funny one that popped into my head. I remember hearing on the radio that back when, in the 80s, when Madonna and Cyndi Lauper were both, you know, on the airwaves, the critics thought that Cyndi Lauper was going to be the one that made it, and they just completely dismissed Madonna. Definitely wrong about that one. We are participants, and we are co-creators in history. We have influence over all of those things. And when you consider that, how does that change your perspective? If you're looking for an educational rabbit hole to go down, go to the Wikipedia entry for List of Common Misperceptions. It's very long. It's a long list of about hundreds of so-called facts that have been mistakenly and probably believed and probably still believed in by millions. And let that lead you to a page with an entry titled List of Cognitive Biases, in case you need more evidence of how many forces are working against our own self-righteousness. I thought in particular it was interesting to read about naive realism. According to a citation of a 1996 article by Lee Ross and a fellow psychologist, Andrew Ward, there are three interrelated assumptions or tenets that make up naive realism. Ross and Lee argue that these assumptions are supported by a long line of thinking in social psychology, along with several empirical studies. According to their model, people, and I want you to listen to this and self-reflect on if any of this feels true for you, believe that they see the world objectively and without bias. Expect that others will come to the same conclusions so long as they are exposed to the same information and interpret it in a rational manner. Assume that others who do not share the same views must be ignorant, irrational, or biased. So everyone else is biased except for me, and I'm right. We know intellectually that being wrong about one thing doesn't mean that we're wrong about everything, but emotionally we become attached to our truths. And as naive realism tells us, we are befuddled when others don't see things our way, especially when shown the same evidence. Not only that, but we will engage in Olympic-level mental gymnastics to defend and validate those truths, even when, and especially when, we're presented with contradictory information. And while there's a chance that we might have our facts wrong, that kind of wrong isn't necessarily a blow to our egos. What we're usually more concerned with is having our opinions and values challenged. That's the more emotional part of relationships that cause the political and the social breakdowns that we have. It's not wrong to have opinions and beliefs. What can go very, very wrong is when we start imposing those beliefs on others and think that what's right for us is what's right for somebody else. Humility says that there is more than one way of doing or seeing something. And our lack of openness and humility becomes a straitjacket. It closes us off and it locks us down and it makes us unable to open our arms wide and let others in. So that interaction with my friend that I described at the top of the talk, while challenging, was also incredibly enlightening. It brought me a key awareness about an obstacle to humility, that I believe I know what's best for someone else. And once that awareness surfaced, I was able to take a step back. I could let go of needing to assert my beliefs and insisting that my beliefs replace hers. This is just one of many conversations I've had over the years that's highlighted the crucial role that humility plays in building connection and nurturing relationships. And while this was a personal story, it's one I know almost anyone can tell. Swapping out vaccination with voting, or protesting, masking up, speaking out, staying, leaving. The past 6 years have brought countless opportunities for growth, also known as pain, discomfort, disappointment, grief, for all of us, regardless of our politics, our race, our religion, nationality, gender, or age. And in every one of those opportunities, we experience close encounters with the differences we have with others and challenges to our deeply held beliefs that we have choices, just as I did with my friend. Ego or humility, self or others, conflict or collaboration, calling someone out or calling someone in. If I'm stuck in my unhealthy, clinging ego, I'm in a monologue with life. If I at least attempt to stay grounded in humility, I'm in a dialogue, in a conversation. Instead of believing that the only way out is to burn it all down, I can think more expansively and creatively. Because here's the thing about humility. It's not an either or, it's a both and. Humility is most commonly seen as a strength or a weakness, depending on the situation and the mindset of the person judging that situation. It's a strength when we're in the role of a learner or a follower. In those cases, to practice humility means to admit that we don't know it all and that we can learn from others. It's healthy humility that keeps us open and embracing a beginner's mind. There's a fine line, however, that gets crossed when the person who is teaching or leading uses that call for humility to create an atmosphere of deference or compliance amongst the learners or followers. For instance, the invitation to learners to be humble can be self-serving to the teacher, as it elevates their perceived authority and discourages challenges to that authority. As the learner, humility then moves from strength to weakness, and it lulls the learner into a non-assertive or low-confidence mindset. So as the teacher, lack of humility isn't confidence, it's arrogance. And that's why humility, generous, thoughtful, and mindful, needs to transcend the either-or limitations and become that both-and. You can be both a learner and a teacher, a follower and a leader. You can be confident in what you know and be excited to share it while also being open to new information and possibilities. You can step forward to serve as an example even as you acknowledge that we can be examples to one another. And when we are right, when we are proven right in some way, like the vaccine, we need to extend more grace and more compassion and humility. We can see it as evidence that people can change. Because don't we want people to extend that same grace to us? How often do we remember to extend it to others? So my response to the question, what if we're wrong about everything, is another question. What is possible if we all, individually and as a society, cultivate and embody authentic, generous, healthy humility in every aspect of our lives? One perspective was voiced by our own Ellie Williams, who is sitting right back there, who offered a wise self-reflection during TalkBack last week when she said, "My reality is I don't know, and I'm okay with that." I just love that. When you consider how much good Ellie has done in the world in her 86 years, then being okay with "I don't know" can't be such a bad thing. In that same discussion, we talked about the wonders of space travel and the way people felt when they first saw the image, the blue marble. And Kent said it was humiliating in a good way. I find it interesting that an image made possible because of our incredible intellectual and technological power had the effect of making us feel insignificant in the best possible way. And in pre-talk, we mentioned that we have no idea what the future holds. We are just, David shared a quote from Walt Whitman, and I'm paraphrasing, but basically we are just one verse in the larger poem. So if we could cultivate healthy, authentic, generous humility, what would change? I think it's helpful to go back to the origins of the word humility and recalibrate our collective relationship to it. Humility has its roots in the early 1200s, and its journey to our modern lexicon goes through Middle English. From Old French, from Latin humilis, low or lonely, and from humus, ground. Other root definitions say that to be humble means to be insignificant, on the ground. Looking closer at humus, we learn that it's not just what you dip your pita chips in, but we learn that it's an organic component of soil formed by the decomposition of leaves and other plant material by soil microorganisms. It is essential to the fertility of the earth. I respect the association with insignificance in the healthy sense, in that it pierces our ego and keeps us from getting too full of ourselves and our self-importance and our need to be right. But I'm more interested in that decomposition aspect. If we allow ourselves and our egos to decompose, what results is fertilizer for new possibilities to emerge. If we submit to that process of breaking down, we create space for, maybe we got that wrong. There's a chance that we'll change our hearts and minds, and that we will do so honestly. And this is a good spot, as I come to a close, to refer to the second reading in your bulletin, which comes from Eric Elms, who writes in his book, Gifts of the Dark Wood. Humility is what keeps us grounded in reality. It is also the quality that best ensures that the internal images that shape our lives, images that influence us as parents, spouses, professionals, spiritual seekers, and so forth, will be large enough to allow us to move freely in the world, rather than cage us in. If we not only want to heal our divides, but forge new alliances, we must practice healthy humility that's grounded in reality. This is humility as an act of generosity, not deference or false modesty. It's a willingness to let our tightly held beliefs about ourselves and the world be challenged, with the hope that something new will form from the compost of our egos. The invitation for all of us is to approach this one life we have with a sense of wonder and humility so that we can fully and freely experience all of its gifts. Last week, we heard that learning how to kneel is part of how we should live in relation to the universe. When you think about kneeling, it's a gesture of humility and honoring, of acknowledging mystery. We're touching the ground while looking up and ahead. It's a vulnerable gesture, because if we're attacked, we're in no position to fight. But we're also rooted and balanced. While the talk last week and this week was focused on different questions, there's a similar conclusion. We might not know what a prayer is, or if the universe is friendly, and we might be wrong about something, anything, everything, but if we learn how to kneel, to practice the healthy humility that leads us to expanding possibility instead of shutting down into arrogance, then there's still hope for us all, even if we are actually wrong about everything. Thank you.